Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in
a... Kia ora, listeners. I'm here today with Owen Gill, the author of Turning Point, Auckland. Kia ora, Owen. Thanks for coming in.
Kia ora, Karen. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. I really enjoyed reading your book. It's a slim book, but well-packed. No padding, well organized, very readable, and a dose of humor, which always helps. I love the chapter headings. My favorite was perhaps California Dreamin'.
Oh, yeah.
I also liked Take Me to Your Leader.
Sure.
Besides being readable, a very thought-provoking work, as to be expected. So because Owen is a public policy advocate who's worked in New Zealand and Australia in urban services, banking and regulation, with degrees in politics and public policy from Victoria University. But he was born in Auckland and lives here, so he's writing as one of us, as well as a policy wonk. Owen, first of all, I'd like to commend you on your footnote defining public policy. So those of you who are listening, don't groan. It's a footnote, but it's a good one. Listen through to the end. Public policy, the coordinated, ongoing decisions that a government or city authority makes in order to achieve certain specified outcomes that will be enjoyed by the population. Is that an original touch of yours, that the main measure of the outcomes is that they will be enjoyed by the population?
I think it is. I don't know where it comes from. It'll be informed by dozens of people I've read, probably by a bloke named Charles Lindblom, who used to write on this kind of thing all the time. So any form of government, you know, ranging from Auckland Council through to the government of New Zealand, right through to the UN, and unless you figure out where you're trying to get to and make your decisions consistent with that, you won't get anywhere, right? It's the reason why we have term governments. You know, in New Zealand, they're 3 years. That's one of the shorter ones in the world. The British are often five years, and some of the Australian states are four, to give you enough time to get somewhere. So, yes, that's effectively what public policy is. Mm. You see it every day. You just don't know it.
Yeah, well, to get somewhere also meaning that people see a difference in their life style and quality of life.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you can see some very big examples. You know, the British are trying to execute Brexit at the moment. The origins of Brexit go right back to around about 2012-13, I think, where David Cameron gave an undertaking that he would let the British population vote on whether or not to remain a member of the EU. Here we are 4 or 5 years on, and there's been a consistent series of decisions that get them to the point of leaving. So it's a pretty good example of public policy in action.
In Turning Point, Auckland, you set out a change agenda for Auckland, one that you say is mandatory to embrace if we want Auckland to be a genuine city of the Pacific. Another point that I really liked about your book was that not naming the role of Auckland as a city of the Pacific, a productive city, and of course, as we were saying now, a city which is enjoyed by its population, and that it's vital to adopt this change agenda now, or a change agenda, because we're at a turning point. So what is this for our listeners who haven't read the book yet? What is this turning point?
We're approaching 2 million people quite quickly. So by my calculations, if you take the current population growth rate, we'll pass 2 million people around about 2025. So we're adding, you know, between 40 and 50,000 people, new members of the community every year. That's around 2.6% of the population. Just to give you a read, that's quite substantial growth for a city. Adelaide, which is a bit smaller than Auckland, it's around about 1.2 million people. It's currently adding 1% of population. It's adding, you know, around about 10,000 people a year, I think. So, you know, Auckland is growing very quickly, and we're going to come up to 2 million people very, very quickly. And at that point, all of the problems we currently have will continue to trouble us: housing, public transport, quality of the natural environment being the three biggest ones. But a whole lot of new problems will emerge. And I argue in my book, if we take some action over the next 2 or 3 years, we can start to solve the problems we have now and be ready for the next group of problems that are coming over the horizon.
Yeah, well, it also seemed to me, that's really well said, it seemed to me that, you know, there is a corporate technique of speaking about problems where they're called opportunities rather than problems. <Right. laughs> Auckland Council itself uses this technique, as an employee of Auckland Council, I can say. But in your book, that comes out. So, for instance, with these, what you call the great urban leaps, which I also thought was a great term, of which we're coming up to the second.
Yes.
So you describe it as being not just an expansion, as you've said now, of multitudes, but also a leap of density and a leap which embraces connectivity, whether that be ultra-fast broadband or more runways at the airport or possibly a cruise ship terminal, which I know I shouldn't cherry pick. Of the various proposals, that's probably the one least dear to my heart. But, you know, that's the point. It's about opening up a discussion about the opportunities, right?
That's right. I mean, the second urban leap, let me just quickly explain. So the first one that Auckland experienced was between 1950 and 1976. The population in 1951, I think, was around about 400,000 people, just a bit below that. By 1976, it was coming up for 800,000 people. So population doubled in 25 years. But two other things happened. Auckland grew outwards during that period, not upwards, and there was no densification whatsoever to speak of. So if you look at the population density in Auckland in around about 1951, 52, and then you look at it in 1976, it's the same, except the population's doubled. So the people just grew outwards. So that's the first thing, the big leap in numbers. But the second thing that happened, and you might appreciate this more than most people, is that Auckland became a semi-American city. So modelled on Phoenix, Houston, long strip roads, motorways, housing and employment assembled around those, no public transport at all to speak of, not much high rise, and pushing out hard against its natural limits, right? So if you look at Auckland straight after World War II, it looked like a small port city, 300,000, 400,000 people. By 1976, as I say in the book, by the time Hotel California came out, it was an appropriate title to come out. It looked a lot more like Houston or Phoenix. That's the first leap. The second leap is different. It starts around about 2010, 2012, around about the time of the Rugby World Cup and around about the time the Waterview Tunnel was commenced. Population growth goes up quickly around about that time, up to around about 40,000 additional people per annum. And around the same time, the people who are running Auckland realised that we're going to have to fit more people into the current confines of the city. So the areas around Mount Albert, Mount Roskill, New Lynn, out to the south, those areas will contain around about 40% more population than they currently do over the next 15 or 20 years. Plus, we'll have to go out. So we're still going out, particularly in the north, west and the south. And as you pointed out, also because of the effects of technology, Auckland is much more connected now to the rest of the Pacific and the rest of the world. So there's a second runway coming at Auckland International Airport, which will get direct up to the Gulf States, North America, East Asia. I know it's not popular, but if Auckland wants to continue to participate in the cruise ship industry, it'll have to build some sort of terminal. And thirdly, as we all know, you know, high-speed broadband started coming around about 2010, 2011, and Auckland will be effectively fully wired for it in the next couple of years. So, you know, Auckland is, as you said, is becoming a genuine Pacific city, connected to the rest of the Pacific, west coast of the States, East Asia, Australia, the Gulf States, much more densely populated and much more expansion again on the western, northern and southern boundaries.
Exactly. And, you know, as far as the cruise ships go, that's one of those things you have to see because it's mostly about sustainability. But, you know, how many long-haul jet flights correspond to a cruise ship? I mean, it's a different conversation, but points out the need. No. I thought you were absolutely right to include it because I'm not an expert, so I will need to read up on that. That's what librarians do. That's what everyone should be doing.
By the way, we're sitting in ground zero of densification because we're on the Unitec campus, which, of course, is going to be taken for, I think it's around about 3,000 additional units. So it's currently, you know, a large treaty-filled campus, quite expansive.
Yeah.
Most of it's going to go into a densification, what's effectively a very big densification project.
Yeah, but there's also a proposal, a proposal for a huge park.
On what's currently Chamberlain Park Golf Course? What's currently Chamberlain Park Golf Course? So you drive past it as you go from here into the CBD. Auckland Council want to take that and convert it to an urban park.
Yeah.
It's been all the way to the High Court because the golfers don't want to give it up. And if I remember correctly, I think the High Court has just ruled in favour of the golfers. My hunch is Auckland Council won't give up because this is a very good example that we've raised. You've got to provide urban facilities for densified population. Clearly densified population, you don't have grounds. So if you've got kids and things, there's no backyards, what have you. So urban type parks are one of the solutions. You know, Sydney is full of them. Urban parks of that nature. my hunch is that the Auckland Council won't give up over Chamberlain Park Golf Course.
Yeah. Well, I likened it in my mind. I moved here from Europe, actually, and I likened it immediately to the cities like Paris with the Bois de Boulogne and Florence with the Boboli Gardens, you know, those are the Cascine. So I definitely think they're a major plus point for the residents of any city to have a large public space. Although I do also really appreciate the tiny little parks that Auckland has everywhere. But anyway, so back to our opportunities. So we had, so basically it comes down to, if I've read this correctly, the four main problems would be how to pay for services, the four main problems for Auckland to solve, opportunities. How to pay for services, how to pay for infrastructure, how to preserve our natural environment, and what I call empowerment, which is how Auckland can take direct control or more direct control, or perhaps the first direct control of most of the aspects of its future. And I quite like the way in the book it's not our problem is our services, our infrastructure, but how to pay for the services. I think it gets right to the point. So how do we get the money to invest in service and in services, and how do we get the money to invest in infrastructure? Because we do have the talent to deal with it, as we've shown, you know, in the Unitary Plan, which you highly approve of.
Yes.
So you have some proposals, into the proposals, starting from a better functioning council, which could be done by...
So Auckland Council is currently assembled as 20 members, and plus the mayor, 21, so 21 votes. And the members are split across a series of wards across the city. There's 13. So, for example, if you live in the Mount Albert ward, there's two members. They represent Mount Albert to the council. If you live in the North Shore one, on the Lower Shore, there's two members. They represent the Lower Shore to the council. And it's what's called a representative democracy approach. So the job of a member is to represent their area to the council and to represent the council back to their local people, so for the purposes of consultation, what have you. And the mayor has some executive powers and has a budget of his or her own to spend on policy making. I argue in the book that that's one of the things that's troubling Auckland. Council members have no executive power, and they're not required to pursue any area of public policy. That's why the definition of public policy is early up in the book. So, for example, if you take housing, let's take housing as an example, Auckland Council cannot affect directly the price of houses in Auckland, but it can affect the speed at which they're grown, the speed at which they're built, and the number of them that are built, and the quality of them. Those are the three areas the council can affect. But that's currently done mostly through the bureaucracy. So what I suggest in the book is that Auckland Council ought to become made up of some councillors who are quasi-ministers, so have quasi-ministerial powers, set a policy. So our policy is to accelerate the rate at which houses are being built, raise the quality, and lower the cost of consenting them, etc. That might be a policy package that a councillor might come up with. And that person's job is then to lead that area of policy through the bureaucracy and at the council table, be accountable for it, be accountable to the electors, accountable to the council, and accountable to the people that are directly using the housing services, builders, architects, planners, what have you, and effectively act like a quasi-minister. Now, that will be an unusual thing in New Zealand. There's no local government unit in New Zealand where that occurs, and to my knowledge, there never has been. It's a little bit closer to the approach of an Australian state government, where state governments in Australia have a cabinet. The premier is the chief minister, and ministers are required to lead their areas of portfolio, their areas of policy. But I argue you'll get three things if you did that. You get clear line of accountability, so you know who's in charge and what they've got to do. The council are responsible for housing in this example. You'll get consistency. So once you start out on a route, you keep on it because somebody's got a interest in doing it. And thirdly, you get much better direction of the bureaucracy. So officials who would be working in the area of housing would have a person who is leading them effectively, and they can keep circling back to that person.
And also the councillors not each being only an advocate for their geographical area that elected them, which is the fragment the possibility, unless you have coalitions. And as you point out, the coalitions often don't last or are too, because they're all informal, aren't they?
Correct. And they're often too small. They're often
too small or not long lasting. Yeah. Yes. So, that's part of your, I should have quoted this earlier. The subtitle of this book is Radical Policy to Prepare Auckland for 2 Million People. And the book does not shy from making proposals. So there's another proposal about addressing NIMBYism, which I was quite interested in.
Okay. So NIMBYism is often used as a pejorative term. You know, these people are NIMBYs, they don't want this or they don't want that. So it's described as a thing that opposes, you know, progress often. My view about NIMBYism is it's not necessarily bad, and that NIMBYs sometimes have a point. One of the biggest rubbing points of NIMBYism in Auckland is densification. So people who oppose, you know, densification in the area, I suggest in the book it's not an original idea. It's taken from an academic at Harvard Law School who came up with it. Let's imagine we're in a suburb and the city's going to build an extra 3,000 units, properties into that suburb's going to be densified. The council would enjoy additional rate revenue off that, obviously. And what I suggest in the book is that some of that additional rate revenue that the council enjoys should be handed over to existing residents as a type of measure to compensate for the fact that the area has become more densified.
So, to alleviate the discomfort that might be caused.
Correct. Yeah. So you effectively discount rates of the existing residents over a 3 or 5 year period. You might be able to discount them up to a third. So average rate bill in Auckland is around about $2,500. So I suggest in the book that you might be able to discount somebody's rates around about $800 because they live near an area that's been densified.
Yeah. And in terms of the rate increases, you've also got a very interesting proposal about appointing a regulator or establishing a regulator who would have an oversight over rate increases.
Yeah, that's true. So one of the notable things about Auckland is that there are three quite substantial monopolies. So single providers, and you've got to take their services. Their water care, so there's no alternative water provider in Auckland. Auckland Transport, so there's no alternative public transport provider. And Auckland Council itself, for the purposes of its urban services, animal control, food regulation, parks, consenting, these types of things. There's about 7 or 8 areas of service where you have to take Auckland Council services. There's no other provider. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but I argue that that gives those three enterprises an enormous amount of commercial power because they can take prices up and they can vary service without suffering competition. And I argue in the book that Auckland ought to have a regulator. So, you know, when I say a regulator, it might be a group of 8 or 9 people whose task it is to report to the council both on the cost of services and the quality of services you're getting, and give the council advice as to whether or not those cost increases, service variations are acceptable. And I go as far as to say in the book that the regulator ought to have veto power over some forms of price increase. So I'll make that very practical. So Watercare says to the regulator, we want to take our prices up 1.5% this year. The regulator would study that, report to the council in detail, and could say to the council, don't allow it because we're not seeing the increases in quality that we might anticipate. They're very common regulators, these type of regulators. Most of the East Coast Australian states have them. New South Wales has one. Queensland has one. Typically in Australia, they report on water, public transport fares, energy, those types of things.
Mm-hmm. So what you've done a lot here is thinking, if I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, Auckland is, the change is happening now. We have an opportunity to learn from what other big cities around the world have done to make their path smoother or did not do.
Yes.
And to take advantage of that now as we're building.
Yes, that's true. I mentioned in the book there's an interesting model, which is Melbourne. Auckland's in roughly the same position that Melbourne was in the early 1990s. Melbourne was struggling. It was not the most desirable city in Australia at the time. It had run out of capital, so they were having difficulty building new things. Big Australian businesses didn't want to go there. They typically went to Sydney. People find this remarkable when you say it now, but Melbourne looked like a pretty dreary prospect at that time. A group of people got into power in the state government in Victoria at the time, led by Jeff Kennett was the Premier and Alan Stockdale was his Treasurer. I don't advocate the way Stockdale and Kennett behaved. They were pretty ruthless about some of the things they did, and they rolled over opposition in a pretty heavy-handed way, so I'm not advocating that. But they did do some quite imaginative things. They released a lot of commercial land in Melbourne, so Docklands. They brought in private investors, which led them to get South Bank. So the entertainment precinct on South Bank was a Jeff Kennett, Alan Stockdale idea, privately funded. Federation Square was their idea. So they effectively opened Melbourne up. It took quite a while, took a decade or so for it to gain momentum, and they were assisted by the fact that two premiers who followed them, Steve Brumby and Steve Brax and John Brumby, continued. So Brax and Brumby came after them. They were Labor premiers. Kennett was a Liberal one. But everybody agreed that to get Melbourne from where it was to where it needed to be, they had to stick to the line. There's a lot to be learned from Melbourne. Auckland's not in the same position in the sense that it is still quite a desirable place to live. But we could learn a lot from what happened in Melbourne over that decade.
Mm. And speaking, so you mentioned Docklands and other developments in Melbourne, particularly aesthetically pleasing as well as functioning, as well as having provided economic opportunities. So, which brings me to another thing I wanted to ask you about, which is beauty. So, La Grande Bellezza, so beauty of Auckland. So we all know Auckland has a huge potential for beauty, but what could we be doing better here? So,
This book is partly informed, by the way, by Graham Scott, who was a principal at ASC Architects, who helped me out in the early stages. He showed me some examples of non-beauty, which there's one in the book, which is the Fanshawe Street flyover.
Absolutely. He's got my vote on that. Number one, yeah.
So for those of you who haven't seen the book, the Fanshawe Street flyover is the big flyover that comes up off Quay Street, goes up over the Tepid Baths, and probably goes up, I don't know, probably about 14 or 15 metres. It's quite steep. I don't know when it was built, but Graham Scott pointed it out to me, and he said to me, if you took it down, you would liberate an entire city block. So the Tepid Baths, which is one of the most beautiful pieces of
architecture.
Yeah, early century architecture. Yeah. I think it was built in the 30s. Is completely overshadowed by it. The buildings in front of it, so the new hotel that's in front of it, and what will be Commercial Bay are partly overshadowed by it. And it also has meant that the car parking building, that, which is just beside it as well, has stayed. I suspect if the flyover went, the car parking building would go.
Yeah.
And Graham Scott pointed out to me how many examples of that sort of brutalism there are in Auckland. Beauty, yeah. So architectural beauty and natural beauty. Start with the latter. Auckland is the only city in the world that's on two harbours, and I argue it's on three because the Kaipara Harbour is effectively a third one.
Yeah.
Not many Aucklanders know about it, but it's a big thing. It's the only city in the world that's on that combination of harbours. It's probably the narrowest isthmus city in the world. So, you know, an isthmus being a leg of land between two large bodies of water. I live in the New Lynn area. Not many people realise it, but the Waitemata and the Manukau come so close there that for many years, as recently as World War II, there was a proposal to dig a canal through New Lynn to connect the two harbours. Whatever you did in Auckland, you don't want to start to routinely trade off its natural beauty. And I say in the book, you know, repeatedly that the ranges out to the west and the harbours, you've got to ensure that you're not constantly taking them to bits, because you will very quickly lose one of Auckland's biggest qualities.
As you say, for instance, face up to losing the port as a working port.
Correct, yeah. I argue that the port is both an economic and an aesthetic issue. It's economically an issue in that if you put it somewhere else and agglomerate and accumulated two of the other ports in the Upper North Island, which are Northport and Tauranga, you've got to get an economic scale argument. And aesthetically, well, to be frank about it, you know, Auckland is now one of the few cities in the world that has a downtown port. The one in Sydney's gone. The one in Brisbane's gone. A couple of the Italian cities have moved theirs as well. A couple of the North European ones have gone through the same process.
And a lot of major cities never had the port, like Lima never had a port. It was Callao and so forth, yeah.
Correct, yeah. I mean, it's a legacy of, you know, Auckland as a post-treaty city. So the port came after the treaty was signed. And a colonial city, the only way to get things back to the mother country at that time was to ship them. So it is a legacy of Auckland's origins, but one we've got to face up to.
And turn our eyes towards the future.
Yeah.
So the people turning their eyes to the future, you've got a good description here, which I really loved, which I'm going to share with our listeners very quickly. So people who will fare well in Auckland will be willing to live in higher density housing, whether rented or owned, move closer to concentrations of jobs and work for less commuting, embrace artificial intelligence at work, in schools, hospitals, and home, negotiate the social and political borders between New Zealand and the economies of East Asia and India, and identify the business and economic opportunities in climate change and in economies with much lower per capita carbon output. So, wonderful list. And back to the using the term opportunity, this is a wonderful list of opportunities. So, what really comes through here to me is the optimism that, you know, you say in the book that you are an optimist. You don't say you're an optimist. You say you're optimistic about the chances for Auckland.
Right.
Hopefully you're also an optimist. So, why are you optimistic?
I think three reasons. I think that if you look at the fundamentals that Auckland has, they're very good and they're very desirable. Outstanding workforce, highly qualified, very flexible, natural beauty. Auckland doesn't suffer from some of the ills that the big Australian and US cities suffer from. We've managed to avoid them. Low crime and corruption. You know, if you want to live in, see what it's like to live in a city with high corruption, live in Sydney or LA, you know, it's a constant. Our homelessness issue is still relatively modest. You know, you're from California. You know, the LA County has 70,000 homeless people, and that's people who have nowhere to go.
Yeah.
Depends which county you believe. There's another one that's around about 50,000, but that's extraordinary, right? Auckland's is believed to be around about the 1,000 or 2,000 number. I'm optimistic in the sense that we haven't managed to catch, you know, the really bad urban diseases. We've got a great workforce. Most Aucklanders still have enormous goodwill towards Auckland. You know, you come across cities where people actually despise the city, but that's not the case here. We are still, you know, sufficiently back down the curve to be able to make changes and embrace changes that will make the city much, much better. We're not so far advanced that we can't, you know, we can't make changes. I'm enormously optimistic about it.
Yeah, so when you said there, you know, Aucklanders don't despise their city, which is really true. I mean, as I say, coming from living in Europe, in Italy, I live in a city where 90% of the inhabitants despise it.
One was that? Naples?
Florence, Italy.
Oh, Florence. Right. Yeah.
As compared to the number of tourists who come through and love it, who are 14-1, right, tourists to residents. But so Aucklanders, however, you point out very well as the book comes to a close, that they may not despise their city, but they need to get off the fence and they need to do something very important, which is to vote.
Yes.
Because you point out, is it 6 out of 10 eligible voters didn't vote in the last election?
Correct. Yeah.
So why is this, and how can we get these people out there to vote?
It's an interesting question. It's not just about getting people out to vote. I think the second to last chapter in my book is called New Compact, and I say that one of the things that's missing in Auckland, there's a few things that are missing, but this is one of them, is an idea of what it means to be a citizen of Auckland. Aucklanders have a very loose idea of what it means. Beaches, the Warriors, a couple of things like that, but that's pretty loose. You're an American, you've had this experience, I know. You know, if you meet a New Zealander overseas, you ask them where you're from, they say, I'm from New Zealand. If you meet an American, they say, I'm from LA, Chicago, New York. If you meet a Brit, they often tell you, I'm from London or Manchester. So we've got to deepen the idea of Auckland as a place that belongs to people and people belong to it. Voting, there's roughly 1.2 million eligible voters in Auckland. Typically, you know, 600,000 or 700,000 of them don't vote. The election's on the 10th of October. It's a postal election. It's very easy to do. There's plenty of websites that'll tell you which way candidates are going. At least vote.
Yes, well, actually, I was going to say, read this book and then go and vote. Because as a librarian, this is what I want people to do. I want people to read books like this, also blogs, and to listen to podcasts, and, you know, how far we've come since the old pamphlets, the old revolutionary pamphlets. But this is a radical book with some radical proposals. You need to all go out there, read this book, and then go out there and express your opinion on Auckland, as the book encourages you to do.
That'll be great. The book is very short. It's 130 pages. It was written to be read in 2 hours. You should be able to fly to Wellington and fly back and read the whole thing. The ideas are relatively simply explained. There's a few numbers in it, but we've, you know, reduced the numbers. It's very specific. You know, we actually make proposals about things that could be done and how.
That's exactly, better words could not have been spoken. Thank you very much for coming in on this. Fortunately, that's all the time we have today, but we might have you back.
Thank you, Karen. Great to talk to you.
This program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond. Every day, every day, every day, every day.